Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Mass immigration, which is fundamentally transforming Europe into a third world continent, and which is fundamentally transforming parts of the United States, like California or Minnesota, into third world hellholes, is obviously a hot topic these days of deep concern to Americans who care about this country and about Western civilization more generally. The conversation about mass immigration in America usually centers on how the Democrat Party has intentionally facilitated it for years, especially during the Biden administration, and fought against voter reform in order to create an entire underclass of illegal voters who will ensure permanent one-party hegemony for the Democrats, because they know they can't win elections fairly, because their policies and values are stupid and unworkable and indefensible and un-American. But I don't know if most Americans know how truly, insidiously subversive this movement of mass immigration is, or the various ways in which it is being weaponized against American citizens by our enemies, both foreign and domestic, in order to undermine our liberties and literally destroy our country as we know it. It's not just about amassing more Democrat voters. It's about waging a war against our society, our values, and our freedom. In this episode, I'm going to talk to my friend Peter Schweitzer about his new number one bestseller, which is a must-read. I know I say that about a lot of books whose authors I have on, but if you read just one book this year, as the cliche goes, make it this one, The Invisible Coup, How American Elites and Foreign Powers Use Immigration as a Weapon. It's been out for a couple of months, but I just finished reading it, and this book will blow your mind, and this conversation is going to blow your mind. So stay tuned, and don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is the president of the Government Accountability Institute and author of about a half dozen number one New York Times bestsellers, including Clinton Cash, Profiles in Corruption, and Blood Money. He came on the show a while back to talk about that last one, which is about how American elites turn a blind eye while China's communist regime kills Americans. His latest book is The Invisible Coup, How American Elites and Foreign Powers Use Immigration as a Weapon, which we're going to get into today. Peter Schweitzer, welcome back to the Right Take Podcast.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Your connection to the Freedom Center goes back a long way. I asked you this the last time, but I think it's worth bringing up again. Tell us how the late David Horowitz gave you your first job out of college.
He did. I graduated from George Washington University in 1987, and I went to work at the National Forum Foundation, which had something called the Second Thoughts Project, which David Horowitz ran with Peter Collier, his longtime collaborator. Yes. And the first time I met David, I'd kind of heard about him, but I didn't know anything about him. Of course, this is pre-internet days. And I walked into a hotel room where he was staying, and he turned around, and he was wearing cowboy boots, a cowboy buckle, and a t-shirt that said, "Kill a commie for your mommy." And I thought immediately, I'm going to like this guy. So David was my introduction to working full time in the conservative movement. And of course, that Second Thoughts Conference, I think, made a huge difference in bringing a lot of people who had been on the left back to the right.
Yes, that's a great story. Tell us what goes on at the Government Accountability Institute. What's its mission?
We are looking to expose cronyism, corruption, threats to the United States that we think are being ignored. They're being ignored, I think, primarily because there aren't very many institutions these days that can take the time to do the real drill down research work that needs to be done. So much of it now is being driven by the quick tempo of the internet, by podcasts that are coming out daily. So we really take our time to drill down on those deeper issues. So we are a research organization, an investigative research organization, and everything that we put in our product, you should be able to find yourself. In other words, there's no take our word for it. There's no anonymous sources. It's all paper trail, follow the money. We've been doing it for about 14 years, and we feel like the void continues to be there, and we're going to continue to do what we do.
Well, you're doing great work there, so thanks for that, and keep that up. Let's talk about your new book. Congratulations on another New York Times number one bestseller. This book is absolutely mind-boggling and enraging. I don't even know where to begin discussing it. The invisible coup of the title, of course, is the weaponization of immigration, the subversion, the foreign interference, the election manipulation, military infiltration, non-assimilation, the clash of civilizations. This book covers so much ground. Was there any aspect of it or angle of it that particularly shocked you or that you couldn't and maybe still can't get your head around?
Good question. Probably two aspects of it. I mean, I was intrigued with this idea of weaponized immigration. I read this academic book a couple years ago, a scholar writing about how immigration can be weaponized and using a lot of historic examples. So I was intrigued with this idea, but there were probably two elements that surprised me the most. The first one was China's continuing industrial scale exploitation of birthright citizenship. You know, the birthright citizenship, Supreme Court's going to be hearing the case. That's this idea that if your mother happens to be within the borders of the United States and she gives birth, regardless of how or why you're here, you are automatically granted U.S. citizenship. And what China has done is created this birth tourism industry where we're literally looking, I think, at more than 1 million, quote-unquote, U.S. citizens that are being raised in communist China right now. These are the parents of the elite. They purposely flew their wives and girlfriends to the United States for the explicit purpose of giving birth so their children would be U.S. citizens. I think that's largely for subversive reasons. So that was the first surprise to me, the large-scale nature of birth tourism practiced by China. The second big surprise to me was the attitude of Mexico's political elite towards mass migration. I kind of assumed they thought the United States is a safety valve. This is a way to kind of, have people go to the United States to find jobs that can't find jobs in Mexico. And I was actually stunned how openly they expressed their views in the Mexican media and government reports about how this is actually a means by which they believe they are going to re-exert sovereignty over portions of the United States. This idea of reconquista, which I always thought was kind of like this fever dream or this conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
But the fact is they talk about it all the time, and I was quite stunned by that.
Yeah, tell us some more about that Reconquista strategy. I wanted to ask you about that, about the strategy to reclaim the American Southwest.
Yeah, I mean, let me just read a couple of quotes. I mean, because sure. I think people are surprised at how blatant these officials are. And literally, I could read a dozen of them. The first one, this is from a Mexican senator, Felix Salgado. He's with the ruling Morena Party. He's a member of the National Defense Committee, which is the Senate, Mexican Senate's most powerful committee. He said this just a couple years ago, quote, "Mexicans are in our territory. California, Nevada, Texas, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, and Wyoming. We're going to take back the territory that was stolen from us." Hmm. And I first read that and I thought, this is like nuts.
Yeah.
But then I kept reading it. I mean, I'll read one more. This is from December of 2024. Gabriela Rodriguez, she's a top aide to President of Mexico, Sheinbaum. Again, December 2024, quote, "We already know that the Mexican population in the United States reaches 39.9 million. We Mexicans are reclaiming our territory."
Hmm.
So this is their attitude. And they've actually set up, as I describe in the book, a political infrastructure. This is not just talk. This is just not sort of blowing off steam. They've actually created political networks in the United States that has already extended Mexico's government sovereignty into our country. So this is a real, real thing.
I'm going to jump around quite a bit because, as I mentioned before, you cover so much territory in this book. How did this weaponization of immigration begin? You have a chapter about Castro's 1980 Mariel boat lift as the first successful deployment, shall we say, of mass migration as a weapon. What was the purpose of that boat lift, and does it serve as kind of a blueprint today for similar orchestrated surges?
Yeah, great question. Yes, and I think it absolutely is. It's proof of concept, as I showed, that you can actually weaponize immigration and wreak havoc on a country, which Cuba did in 1980 with the Mariel boat lift. In fact, our federal government had a study group in the early 2000s look at what have been the most successful attacks on the United States in all of our history. Number one was 9/11. Number two was Pearl Harbor. And number three was the Mariel boat lift.
Wow.
And what's interesting, when you look at all three of those in terms of the damage they inflicted on our country, quite substantial. But what happened to Al-Qaeda after 9/11? We basically destroyed them. What happened to the Japanese Empire after Pearl Harbor? We destroyed them. What happened to the Cuban government after the Mariel boat lift? Nothing. That's what makes immigration, I think, such a powerful, potent weapon. In this particular case, Fidel Castro saw an opportunity. In the spring of 1980, there was discontent in Cuba. Some people wanted to leave. He said, go ahead and leave. And he said, but you know what? I'm going to seed this flow of migrants out of Cuba with psychopaths, with criminals, with street gang members, with intelligence officers, and I'm going to use it as a way to effectively weaponize immigration. And over the course of about half a year, 125,000 Cubans came to the United States. Many of them were refugees, but many of them fit into these other categories. And Castro considered this an enormous success, and I think by any measure, it absolutely was. Crime rates went up across American cities. The drug trade was enhanced substantially because of many of these criminal networks that came here started, you know, bringing in drugs into the East Coast of the United States. Intelligence operatives were put into place. And this was a proof of concept because in that summer of 1980, when this was unfolding, Fidel Castro went to Nicaragua to celebrate the one-year anniversary of the Sandinistas seizing power in that country. And there at the airport where they had the celebration, you had Fidel Castro, you had Daniel Ortega, who was then and is now the leader of Nicaragua, and you had Lula da Silva, who is now the president of Brazil and at the time was a left-wing activist. Castro at that time was bragging how successful this was. Move forward to what happened in the Biden administration, where it's not 125,000 Cubans. It's, by some estimates, tens of millions of people from around the world. And who played a crucial role in that? Lula da Silva, president of Brazil, and Daniel Ortega, who is the president of Nicaragua, who, after Joe Biden was elected in 2020, said around the world, if you want to get to the United States illegally through Mexico, fly from anywhere around the world to Nicaragua. We'll welcome you in, we'll get you to the border, and we'll help get you into the United States. And the estimates are that some 2 million people from Asia, Africa, from everywhere around the world flew to Nicaragua, and that was part of this torrent and flood that we saw. So it was proof of concept with Fidel Castro. It was a highly successful attack on the United States by any measure. It was replicated on a thermonuclear scale during the Biden administration, and we are still facing the consequences of it. And again, remember, the people perpetuating this, no one ever pays a price. You can't bomb them. You can't attack them. So it is, in a sense, the ultimate weapon to deploy against the United States. That is weaponized immigration.
Yes. Well, I think this ties into a question I wanted to ask you about your chapter, Importing the Revolution. You write about radical foreign political movements quietly seizing control of U.S. institutions through non-assimilating migrants. Which ideologies and groups are driving that takeover?
It's a great question. There's a couple of them. And I don't know that These groups are necessarily in any alliance. They don't need to be. They have a, they have a common purpose and a common interest. The first one that I would look at would be Marxist, radical Marxists, self-described radical Marxists from Latin America. These are people that were members of the FMLN, which is a radical Marxist insurgency in El Salvador, which later morphed into a left-wing political party in that country, and members of the FSLN, who are the ruling party of Nicaragua. If you chart these migrants that came illegally into the country in the 1980s, 1990s, and early 2000s, they now run many of the most radical labor movements in the United States. I'm not talking about the Teamsters and skilled laborers. I'm talking about SEIU, unskilled unions. They are now dominated by these radical Marxists. So that's one group. The other political movement that's exploited this is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood, who sees and has always seen immigration as a powerful means by which you can subvert foreign countries, particularly Western countries, certainly in Europe, but also in the United States. Even though you don't have the same numbers in terms of sheer numbers of Muslims that you have in Europe, it still is a major organizing political problem in the United States and represents a very real threat.
You mentioned that there's not necessarily an official alliance, but they have the same goal. What is the end game of weaponizing immigration against the United States?
Yeah, it's the destruction of the United States. And they essentially say that. I mean, you guys at the Freedom Center have done enormous groundbreaking work. I think David was one of the first people to highlight the so-called red-green alliance between Islamists and Marxists. And you know, there's a meeting I recount in my book. There's a famous meeting that apparently took place in 2007, where the adult children of Che Guevara, his son and his daughter, who both live in Cuba, traveled to Tehran to meet with the mullahs to see if there was the possibility of working together. And by all accounts, the meetings did not get off to a good start. The mullahs claim that Che Guevara worshipped Allah, which, of course, wasn't true, and his children criticized and denounced. They set aside the religious discussion and said, how can we work together? And the conclusion was, we can work together by destroying the United States. We'll worry about our differences later. Right now, let's just focus on just destroying the United States. And that's really what the mass migration is about for these activist groups. It's about transforming the United States by importing people that have ideas, ideologies, and belief systems that are antithetical to traditional American beliefs. They're less individualistic. They're more trusting and wanting the government to take care of them. They're less tolerant of dissident political views. It's a more collectivist mindset. And when you look at the surveys and the polls that are done on immigrants that come into the country and their political attitudes and how those attitudes often remain, they're right. It absolutely is changing the United States.
And I think Europe, too, even though your book really addresses America, but that's certainly, you can see the same weaponization of immigration happening throughout the Western world, especially in Europe. Would you say that's tied in with just an overall assault on Western civilization?
Oh, 100% assault on Western civilization. That is really the basis of it. And really, if you look at, for example, the Chinese Communist Party, their view of their competition with the United States is not ultimately, you know, spheres of influence, military competition, trade. They say point blank, we are fighting American Judeo-Christian civilization. Yeah. We have a superior civilization. We need to take down American civilization. When you look at the views of a lot of the radical activists in Latin America, the same thing. I mean, people sometimes say, well, you know, they come from Catholic countries, but these are not Catholics. These are Marxists. These are radicals who, in a sense, reject the Spanish role in Latin America, embrace the sort of indigenous values of that region, and reject Western values. And of course, with the Islamists, it's pretty clear. So yes, there is this common thread and this common belief that the world's problems, in their view, will not go away until American civilization and Western civilization, including Europe, is ultimately destroyed. And the way to accomplish that is not by going to a war, having a shooting war, which they cannot win. Yeah. It is by subverting the country through mass immigration. They say so explicitly. They've done so explicitly. And they have a lot of fruit to show for their efforts thus far.
The Muslim Brotherhood refers to it as civilizational jihad. Let's talk about China for a moment. You've already touched on this a little bit, but could you drill down a little further into what you call the Manchurian generation and how it represents really just one of the most insidious national security threats?
Yeah, this is the rise of birth tourism in China. And it's really odd in a way when you first look at this. In 2011, 2012, the Chinese Communist Party started running articles in the People's Daily, which is their major newspaper, about, and they're saying this, of course, to the Chinese Communist Party members. That's who reads the People's Daily. It says you have a constitutional right in the United States to get citizenship for your children. And it is part of the 14th Amendment. And they describe this in excruciating detail. Yes. So the first thing you wonder is, why is the Chinese Communist Party leadership telling its elite they have a right to do this and saying you should do this? And so that was the first thing that happened in the early 2010s. The second thing is the rise of this birth tourism industry, which literally includes more than 1,000 companies. And these are companies that openly advertise in China. So again, you have the support of the Chinese Communist Party for this. These companies, if you are a member of the Chinese elite, you pay them, say, $80,000. They help get you into the United States. They help you to basically lie on your visa, to tell your wife or your girlfriend, go to the United States. Do not tell them you're coming for a medical procedure. Say you're coming on a tourist visa. Once you're in the country, they arrange housing for you. There are apartment blocks in Southern California that are completely filled with these Chinese nationals. They then arrange for the medical procedure to take place to give birth. They get that all-important birth certificate. And then, of course, as soon as the child is able to fly home in a matter of a week or so, they fly back to China where they will be raised as members of the Chinese elite. But they are now U.S. citizens or can become U.S. citizens by virtue of that birth certificate. So this is an industrial scale exploitation of birthright citizenship. And we have no idea in the United States what the numbers are because we don't keep track of the national background of parents. It's not on any birth certificate. But the Chinese government and Chinese research firms have looked at this, and the numbers are eye-popping. They believe that on average, over the last 13, 14 years, every single year, roughly 100,000 Chinese babies have been born in the United States, either in the United States or in a U.S. territory by Saipan, where the same rule applies. So we're literally looking at 1 million plus U.S. citizens who have no connection to this country whatsoever, other than their mother flew in momentarily to give birth and then flew them back to China where they're being raised in CCP schools. But when they turn 18, they're going to be able to vote. They're going to be able to donate to political campaigns. They're going to be able to apply for government jobs. This is a massive national security breach, and we are essentially completely unaware of it. And that's why, I wrote the book and why I think this is so vitally important, especially in light of the Supreme Court case and birthright citizenship that they're about to hear.
That is outrageous. And the Chinese Communist Party also uses surrogacy and IVF to create additional quote-unquote American children who are loyal to Beijing. Tell us about that too.
Yeah, I mean, this is in a sense even creepier because what you have is members of the Chinese elite that hire American women to carry their child. Now, they may be carrying a child that's sperm donated from the father. It could be the sperm and the egg from the mother and the father. Either arrangement, it's the same thing. They pay the birth mother $60,000, $70,000 to carry the child to term. The child is born. The child is born in the United States, so it's a U.S. citizen. It now also technically has a biological mother, so that also defers citizenship on it. But as soon as that child is born and able to fly, it is flown back to China. And oftentimes, birth mothers in the United States will report the parents don't even show up to pick up the child. So there's this whole question of where are some of these children ending up? We have no idea. There's no numbers here. The Chinese government has not even done estimates, but a couple of examples are eye-popping. There was a case in Southern California, CCP member, CCP official, who was found to have 26 children through this. His plans, by the way, according to media accounts, were for one of those children to become president of the United States one day. The other example I would give comes from a Wall Street Journal cover story about 2 months ago, where a Chinese billionaire close to the CCP was said by his aides to have more than 100 children that have been born this way, that would all be U.S. citizens. So this is a subversion of the United States. And it should be pointed out, by the way, that similar techniques were used in Hong Kong in the early 2000s, but because Hong Kong had birthright citizenship in the early 2000s. But they discovered what China was doing with so many births that they had to ban birthright citizenship in China in Hong Kong in 2013. That's why I think in part they switched to the United States to carry out the tactic here.
Okay, another question about China. Peter, why are we allowing clandestine programs in California and Arizona to train thousands of Chinese military pilots each year?
Yeah, great question. Another use of immigration as a form of weapon. In this case, these are student visas. And of course, we all remember, at least I remember, old enough to remember, what happened in 9/11. You had those students from the Middle East who went to American flight schools, said they only wanted to learn how to take off. They didn't want to have to learn how to land. We had a federal law that was passed after 9/11 that said if you're from a terrorist sponsoring country, you cannot go to American flight schools. That does not apply to China. And China has a pilot problem. They need about 5,000 civilian and military pilots every year. They can only produce about 1,250 because they have very tight restrictions on airspace. So what they've done is they've sent these students to the United States. The Chinese government pays their tuition. It's like $90,000 a year. The best pilots, once they train here and go back to China, the best pilots will then get advanced military flight training from the Chinese military. So we are literally subsidizing the Chinese military in their production of pilots. It's shocking to me, and again, is an example of how they are taking advantage of the generosity of our immigration system.
Unbelievable. I think when Samuel Huntington coined the famous phrase clash of civilizations, he didn't foresee that clash would actually happen inside America's borders. The last chapter you have is called Fighting Back, and in it you outline some concrete countermeasures to dismantle this invisible coup. Can you share one or two of those countermeasures?
Yeah, well, I think number one, we need to stop training these pilots. We should not have student visas where we're allowing people from adversarial countries learning skills that can be used against us. This, of course, goes to the larger issues of students that are here doing the hard sciences and spying on us. So that would be policy reform, number one. Number two, I really think we need to look at this issue of dual citizenship in the United States. Mm-hmm. Am I concerned if somebody is a dual citizen of the United States and Canada? Not really. Am I concerned if somebody's carrying dual citizenship between the United States and, say, China? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I'm concerned about it. So I think we need to look at that particular issue. The Supreme Court declared in the 1960s that it was unconstitutional to say that you could not have dual citizenship in the United States. I think we need to relook at that. I think the third thing we need to do is in general, is start looking at immigration through this prism of it as a weapon. There's been a big discussion in our country about how it affects our economy, our jobs, how it affects our culture and crime. That's all vitally important. Sealing the border is vitally important. But I think our mindset needs to change. How do our adversaries view immigration, and how are they using it to subvert and undermine us? And part of that, I think, also solution is dismantling these political networks that have been erected in the United States. Mexico, for example, has this bizarre system. I briefed a lot of people in Washington, D.C. before the book came out. None of them knew about this. Mexico actually has more than a dozen senior officials that live inside the United States who serve in the Mexican Parliament and the Mexican Senate, and their job is to represent Mexicans living in our country before their legislature. That, to me, is a massive intrusion in our sovereignty. These elected officials are also involved in organizing anti-ICE protests, anti-Trump protests. Yeah. They're meddling in our elections. We should not tolerate that from any foreign power. So we should also look at dismantling these political networks that have been erected in our country.
Yes, good ideas. And what about your average concerned citizen? Are there practical steps that the ordinary, quote unquote, ordinary person can take to help protect our republic?
Well, I think the first thing is to spread the word about what is happening with immigration. Look, I am the son of immigrants. My parents immigrated from Europe. My mother's from Sweden. My father from Switzerland. I think immigration is a good thing for America as long as it's legal and yes. as long as there is real vetting. But we don't have that. So I think part of it is awareness for people mm-hmm. to be aware of what's going on and sharing this with other people. The other thing I would say is be observant as to what's going on. When you look at some of the birth tourism mills that exist in Southern California, I mean, people are reporting that there are entire apartment blocks in Irvine, California, for example, that are occupied by Chinese women who are here for the total purpose of giving birth. Wow. They should be alerting local news media about that. They should be alerting local officials. In other words, be aware of things that are going on. And if you see things that warrant it, contact the police and contact local authorities.
There is so much more to talk about with this book. We've really only dipped our toes into a few places in it today. I know you're very busy promoting this one, but are you already working on the next book?
I'm thinking about the next book, but I haven't come up with any firm ideas. So if you've got any thoughts, I would love to hear them. But right now, you know, what we always do is we look for threads to pull on. And when everybody is zigging, we try to zag. So the question is, when I release a book 2 years from now, Lord willing, what is going to be of importance and relevance then? And how can we inform that discussion? So haven't decided yet, but I am looking at a few things.
Looking forward to it. How can people best keep up with what you and the Government Accountability Institute are doing?
Well, we have a podcast called The Drill Down. You could please listen to that. It's 20 minutes once a week. So it's short and sweet, and we try to focus on particular topics. You can certainly follow me on Twitter at Peter Schweitzer. And of course, the Government Accountability Institute, we have social media and we have websites, and we have a website, thedrilldown.com, which recounts some of the research and work that we're doing. If you go to our main website, just Google Government Accountability Institute, we actually do have a tip box. So if you are aware of some issue of cronyism, you know, criminal conduct, et cetera, that you think warrants investigation, please do share that with us.
Yeah, that's good to know. Peter Schweitzer, thanks so much for the invaluable investigative work that you are doing, and thanks for coming to The Right Take again.
Hey, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Listeners, get Peter's new book, The Invisible Coup. Like everything else he has written, it is mind-boggling and eye-opening. And thank you for tuning in. As always, don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.